5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. On today's episode, we talk to Victor Rortvedt about crypto and the DeFi space in crypto. We learn about his unique legal background, how he first got into crypto, and how he transitioned from mainstream crypto into the niche within a niche that is DeFi. This was a very fascinating conversation. We learned about why he's interested in MakerDAO and DAI and RDAI, where you can collect interest and either collect it yourself or donate it to many others. And there's a lot of different projects you can donate to, including his passion project, Our Trees. We also learn about his new project, High Priests. If you're really into DeFi and crypto, you're not going to want to miss this one. Things are about to get decentralized, autonomous, and maybe even organized on the dark side of the Huddle Moon.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantech's. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Dark Side of the Huddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye of the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iTheSound.com. All right, and we're back with another episode of The Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. I'm Blockade here with Josh, our awesome co-host. And Josh, we've got another big interview today.
Yeah, we've got a great guest. But before we get into that, I'd like to wish a very happy birthday to my mother, who's 60 years old today. Thanks, Mum. I love you.
All right, Josh, you are such a good son, Josh. Yeah, happy. What's your mother's name, by the way? I don't even know your mother's name.
Jill. Her name is Jill Margaret Igo. Well, she was born Bainbridge, so knee Bainbridge. Good on you, Mum. Hope you're having a nice time in Italy. Yeah. I'm sure that you're listening on the Dark Side of the Huddle Moon podcast.
I'll make her feel at home, I'll use my best English accent. Happy bloody birthday, Jill. All right. So anyways, without further ado, now, me and Josh are really big into crypto and crypto as currency, but what's been really trending lately, and a lot of guests have mentioned it, is DeFi, decentralized finance, and a lot of the interesting applications that are happening there today. So without further ado, let's introduce our guest today, Victor Rortvedt. Victor, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're welcome. You're very welcome. And we're glad to have someone on that's different from some of our other guests. I mean, we've had a broad range of people on so far, but this is the first guy that we've had on that really talks about DeFi and really is pushing new boundaries in this space. So it's going to be a really interesting show, and we're looking forward to getting into it. So before we go into the tech stuff, we always like to talk about the person. We want to get to know you a little bit more rather than just going straight on the promotional angle. We'd rather talk to a real person just like us and get to know the backstory behind Victor. So if you could share a little bit about your background, like Cade always goes through this. It's like, where did you grow up? Any influences in high school or in college? Did you go to college? What did you study? Those types of questions. So it's pretty broad and you can take it wherever you like. So
hobbies, favorite music genre.
Yeah, stuff like that. You like.
Oh boy. Okay. So that's pretty broad. I guess I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. I would say that sort of young age stuff and hobbies and interests all the way through college had nothing to do with where I currently spend my time now. Is mostly interested in film when I was in high school and early college and literature. I went to college in Ohio, studied English, then went to law school and graduated from law school and worked at a corporate defense litigation firm in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And I enjoyed that, but I ended up sort of falling in love with smart contracts and Ethereum and decided to switch everything up a couple of years ago.
Nice, nice. Well, actually, that's good. Actually, a lot of our guests have either come from a tech background or a finance background or a background in law. And it's nice to hear that you actually enjoyed practicing, because a lot of lawyers, they hated it. They thought they were like a glorified secretary or paper pusher, but you enjoyed practicing law?
I did. I had a great team around me, really smart people, and I worked on cases that were sort of very complex litigations that could take about a decade to go through the whole process. And so you really had a lot of strategic planning.
A decade. That's a long litigation process. I didn't even know they could drag out that long.
Yeah, absolutely. These were cases that were often, and I say a case, it would sometimes be a kind of a suite of cases. There'd be a number of times where we'd represent a corporate defendant and they would have been sued in a number of different states for the same sort of actions. And so it was handling a number of different complex litigations to sort of wrangle those together, try to sort of minimize the burden on the company as far as the issues and the facts and the documents would be the same between them. And so you also had a lot of game theoretic planning where you were trying to understand that this wasn't your one chance to sort of swing for the fences, either with the judge or with the opposing counsel even. And so you kind of had to calibrate, you know, make sure that they understood and believed your word, because you were going to have to come back to them and say things to them a number of times more over the next years. And so I really enjoyed that aspect of it, that it wasn't so much a kind of maximum aggression kind of approach, but a calibrated one that sort of was serving the interest.
Sounds like a game of strategy. So like you were really into the strategy of it. And you even mentioned the word game theory right there. So, mm-hmm. I mean, game theory is really important in poker, but this is high stakes poker, really, when you're playing that in terms of decades and for probably hundreds of millions of dollars for these big corporations. That's pretty interesting backstory, and that's pretty unique. All right, so cool. You grew up in did you say Washington, D.C. area, or was it Washington State? Sorry, I didn't
hear that. D.C. area, the capital.
All right, cool. All right, that sounds good. And we kind of breezed over your childhood. Is there anything, any moment that stuck out when you were in high school or in your youth where you were like, all right, this is what I want to do? Was there any like pivotal moment, or were you just a standard student? Was there anything from school that stood out for you?
Oof, gosh, I don't know. I've never been asked that question before. I don't think anything jumps out right now. I don't think anything sort of presages a future. I guess I've always been interested in different things. I've always been following my interests as opposed to kind of thinking like about a maximalist career approach.
Okay, nice. So it was like very eclectic worldview. That's cool. All right, cool. Nice. So let's push on with the next type of stuff. Kate, go ahead.
Yeah. So it's nice to hear that you enjoyed law. So it sounds like you didn't leave law because you hated it. You left it because you found something you liked even more. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I did actually like have a kind of an intellectual crush on law when I first got into it. I really liked the way that it sort of lets you pick apart the world and think about how to address problems, and that continued. But it sort of, I think, found the edges of that approach, I think, as far as like being a satisfactory way to kind of think about problems. And then, you know, decade-long litigations are probably not the best way to solve disputes in general. And so while I enjoyed being in the middle of it and trying to figure out how best to serve my clients and understand the whole big picture, I could also see that this is probably from a larger perspective, not an ideal, ideally calibrated system for handling the types of things that it was handling, which are essentially disputes. Yeah, so
definitely. So to find this other love, you had to have first heard about crypto. So do you remember when, where, how you first heard about crypto? And did it initially stick, or did it take a little time?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, it's hard to say precisely when. I think I definitely know I'm in the camp of probably the majority of folks where there was definitely a first exposure of, oh, what is this thing? That's kind of interesting. And it was probably driven by a price spike in Bitcoin, and then it faded away, not so much because I thought, oh, that's terrible or something like that, but just simply it only captured my attention for a few moments or a day or so. And then it was the next time that something else sort of surfaced. And I think that was in like 2014. It was, I think it was after the 2013 Bitcoin run up, but then the Mt. Gox hack had happened. But then it was after that that I actually started doing a little bit more research. And the I think I saw a video maybe called like the Rise and Rise of Bitcoin, something like that, that kind of put it together in a larger context, not just about a price currency, but about sort of the political implications of it and the overall sort of global nature of it and how it could transform the way that people connect to each other and relate to each other. And that was an interesting moment. And then I just kind of started doing a little bit of the Coinbase investing kind of thing.
Okay, nice. And I want to kind of dive into that a little bit deeper. So when it fascinated you, what fascinated you? Was it the tech? Was it for political or economic reasons? Or was it a little bit of all three, maybe plus making money? Like, what was the thing that drew you to it?
I'd say, I mean, the tech, funnily enough, was the last part to really interest me. It wasn't uninteresting. It just didn't grab me. I'm much more of a humanist and a kind of narrative focused, you know, thinker. And so this idea about the story of Bitcoin and the story of money and the story of how it relates to, you know, sovereignty and how it relates to individual agency and power. And I think this is kind of, if I could rewind almost, there was a good story that Andreas Antonopoulos told that I learned only later, but that I think kind of animated my feelings about what was so exciting about Bitcoin. And he told the story about how he was born, and in many ways he won all kinds of different lotteries in life. You know, he was born in the 20th century where they have cures for all kinds of diseases and people don't, you know, sort of have to fend for themselves against, you know, the elements. And he was born, you know, male, and he was born in Europe, and he was born, you know, with educated parents and all these things that like are in the grand scheme of humanity going back in time, like the 0.1% of the 0.1% of the 0.1%. But then he also says, and I was also born to the Greek drachma. And there were times in his life where that drastically reduced his ability to essentially like seek out opportunities and you know, flourish. And I think that was a compelling story because he then of course followed it up with Bitcoin is the first time he had a choice about his economy and about where he wanted to put his sort of economic well-being. And I think even though I wasn't in a position where I was, you know, having kinds of drachma-like problems economically, I think grasped how much of a change that would be for the world, because I don't have any belief that like the people that currently have the most money are the ones that deserve it the most. I think there's a lot of different factors about where you're born and these kinds of things that affect that. And I think, you know, his point about the drachma really did resonate with me, because you recognize there are parts of the world where you just have incredibly industrious people that are completely hidebound by the situation they find themselves in. So.
Yeah, I think that's a really good story. I think I maybe read that story myself. And yeah, I think maybe all of us here maybe felt like we won the lottery. You know, me, I was born in the 20th century, straight, white, male, born in the U.S., educated parents, come from a, you know, a decent background, you know, also, you know, tall, handsome, athletic, you know, kind of hit the lottery out of the park. I'm just joking anyways. But yeah, that's... So you would say you came at it from kind of a like a humanist utilitarian perspective. You know, obviously even the US dollar inflates, but yeah, with the drachma, with Cyprus, there was the bank haircut. And we've talked about the crazier stories too, like in Venezuela with runaway inflation. So what is your opinion of fiat currency, and did it change after you learned about Bitcoin, like how it can just be printed out of thin air and how it used to be backed by gold? Do you have any thoughts or opinions on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think for me, the first time I ever really thought about and used the word fiat currency was after this, right? It's the kind of thing that like, you know, it's kind of an indicator. It's a big signal to everybody else. If you say the words fiat currency, it means that you're kind of thinking of an alternative. So that was one thing. But I think for me, I'm not sort of motivated, I guess, as much about sort of like a sound money perspective. I guess I kind of view like the state having like, you know, power over the people that are in its territorial jurisdiction, and they can extract taxes, and they always have from that perspective. And so essentially what backs up various state economies is like the state's ability to do that. And so, you know, whether or not that's just or not is a separate question, but whether or not the money supply can like, you know, survive. You know, obviously it depends on inflation, but to some extent, I don't really want to get into this stuff because it's not really what I like thinking about. It's not really what I'm motivated by. I don't have strong views about kind of fiat monetary policies in the same way that I think a lot of folks in the space do. But I think that providing an alternative for people is a really, really powerful political sort of, you know, I'm trying to think of the right word here, but sort of it's a watershed moment. It's a difference that I think is a difference in kind, not in scale, because it just wasn't possible before. And that's really kind of opening up people to understanding that they don't have to sort of see their own position in the world in the same sort of narrow scope that others have.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And obviously you're now involved in DeFi, but around 2013, 2014, when you first heard about it, you know, I don't even know if DeFi was really a thing, or if it was very obscure. So what were the projects you were initially excited about? Was it Bitcoin? Was it Ethereum? Was it a little bit of everything? Like what were you excited about back then when you first heard about it?
Yeah, I guess so Ethereum didn't exist at that point. DeFi, as we call it now, doesn't exist, although there are folks that are saying that, you know, Bitcoin is DeFi. And I guess like in a broad sense, you know, definitionally it is. It is decentralized finance. But I guess the finance part is the difference a little bit. You know, it certainly is a financial product, but it's not you know, products on top of that that serve different needs, at least inherently. And so, yeah, it was certainly Bitcoin. It was certainly the big dog at the time. I don't even really know if I was interested. I can't think of anything that I was interested in at that time. I want to say Coinbase only sold Bitcoin at that point. I don't think, I mean, there wasn't Ethereum. I can't even think of what else would have been essentially like liquid enough and popular enough to be out there. So that was really the only thing I was interested in. And then I started to follow the Ethereum project as it was, I think it was announced at the very end of 2014 or the beginning of 2015 at the Bitcoin conference in Miami. And it sounded interesting. And it took me a little while though to sort of like really kind of warm up to it. And I really didn't get to be especially interested until a couple of years later, like 2016, early 2017.
Nice. So I think that's a good place to transition. So for some of our newer listeners, can you kind of talk a little bit about what Ethereum is, how it's different from Bitcoin, and also what an ERC-20 token is?
Sure. So Ethereum is there's an Ethereum virtual machine, which is like a world computer, and people can write software for it that will be deployed to all the computers and executed on all the computers that are running the Ethereum nodes. It runs on proof of work like Bitcoin does, but the basic idea is that it's designed to be an open programmable system. And I think the best sort of like way to describe this is, as soon as Bitcoin started to get traction, people thought of all kinds of other use cases for blockchains to do things. So they thought about, oh, we could have a blockchain for betting and gambling, and we could have a blockchain for identity, and we could have a blockchain for, you know, sort of like compute power that would be, you know, shared around the world. And so there were a number of different projects that were attempting to sort of build on top of Bitcoin or to do something adjacent to it that would tie into it. And, you know, some of these became termed what were called Swiss Army knives, in the sense that they were saying, you know, the normal Bitcoin base layer as the payments channel, but then you would build another tool for betting, and you would build another tool for compute, and you would build another tool for on and on and on. Like, but you would actually make a finite set of like a Swiss Army knife. Here's a set of 12 tools that we can use to do all these 12 things. And so that idea was essentially what Vitalik Buterin, who was the creator of the Ethereum project and the idea for it, the motivating force, he considered that. He worked on a project in Israel called Colored Coins, where they were doing something sort of akin to this about, you know, tying individual sort of additional tools into Bitcoin. And he came away from that sort of viewing it as not the best way forward, because as soon as you finished making the Swiss Army knife and releasing it to the world, somebody somewhere is going to release the 13th tool and some other new idea that wasn't there. And so what he said was, we should build a programmable open system where essentially people can write arbitrary code. As long as they can program it, it should be able to, you know, perform the functions that that somebody could potentially want to see happen inside of a blockchain. And that's what Ethereum is. So it's essentially a programmable system blockchain that's built on smart contracts executing on inside of the nodes that are running the Ethereum client software around the world.
Yeah, nice. And I think Vitalik actually tried to implement these things on Bitcoin. They weren't really accepted. So he just kind of had to branch out and really do his own thing. And then, of course, we have ERC-20 tokens, where a lot of other altcoins or projects were using those either as a placeholder to raise money or trying to build on top of Ethereum. Now there's other chains that are doing the same thing.
Right.
But then there's been a pretty big project that was built on Ethereum was MakerDAO and DAI. So I'm assuming you're familiar with that, and it was pretty interesting to you, I bet.
Yeah, sure. So MakerDAO actually predates Ethereum. It's one of the very few things, but it really is closely associated with Ethereum. And it's a kind of a wild project, at least at first, but then you sort of realize that they're very serious folks involved in it, and they've been working hard on it for 6 years now. So it seems like, I mean, we always joke about how the calendar year is about 4 crypto years. So that's about 24 years that they've 24 crypto years that they've been working on MakerDAO. And so the basic idea is to create a stable coin. I think one of the things that probably all your listeners know is that cryptocurrencies are synonymous with volatility. Bitcoin and Ethereum, certainly the case. And that is a very difficult thing to sort of make useful, especially for people in the world that kind of need, you know, not only sound money or money that doesn't go away, but also money that they don't have the worry about inflation or deflation or some sort of, and I guess it's not those processes exactly because of the issuance rates, but the volatility of just the speculative price aspect of it is far too severe to sort of make this useful. So one good example is if you wanted to make a bet on using Bitcoin on a sporting event, let's say the Super Bowl for next year, you're making two bets. You're making a bet on who you think is going to win the Super Bowl next year. You're also making a bet on how much Bitcoin is going to be worth in a year, because it could be that you lose the bet and Bitcoin is worth 10 times as much as it was when you made the bet, which is very, very painful. Or it could be that you you win the bet, but or you lose the bet, or sorry, you win the bet and it's appreciated, so you're sort of like doubly winning. So it's a really kind of difficult thing to imagine. So that the idea of a stable coin was very attractive, and you could do a stable coin in a number of different ways. Tether is obviously one. There are a number of them that are IOU stable coins, where essentially a organization with a lot of money says, we are going to essentially lock up real fiat currency or something else that has value outside of cryptocurrency, and then issue IOUs on a blockchain saying, oh, this is backed by, you know, US dollars or euros or gold or whatever it is. But essentially you're trusting that one institution to actually have those reserves and that you could actually get the money out if you needed it. And so those projects, you know, came along relatively early. MakerDAO was aiming for a bigger target. They were aiming for a permissionless, native on-chain stablecoin. And so the way they did that was they took volatile ETH and you would use that as collateral to draw out DAI, which is their stablecoin, DAI. And so if you wanted to create DAI, which was going to be pegged to a dollar, the Maker system said you had to deposit at least 150% of the value that you drew out. And in fact, people have been, you know, essentially over collateralizing it by about 3 or 4 times, depending on where the sort of market is at. But the idea is then you can use a couple of different governance mechanisms to kind of keep the peg of a DAI at a dollar by essentially making it more expensive to mint, or now being able to pay people what's called the DAI savings rate to hold it. And so they use these two mechanisms, the stability fee, the interest rate, and the savings rate, which is essentially, you know, interest like a bank account, to kind of keep the peg at a dollar. And then they make sure that the system is collateralized by essentially liquidating you if you fall below the 150% ratio. So for instance, if you drew out 100 DAI and you had to lock up $150 worth of ETH to do that, and then the price of ETH dropped such that you only had $140 worth of ETH, it would liquidate your ETH to be able to satisfy the $100 DAI debt to keep the DAI system collateralized. So that's I could probably go a lot more deep about it, but that's also probably fairly deep itself.
No, I think that's pretty good. Yeah. So it's, I think that's an important differentiation to make, is that other stablecoins are maybe backed by gold or they're backed by fiat reserves. And this one's a little different because you're using a volatile asset to kind of, I guess, create a stable peg to the dollar. So it's a little bit different, a little kind of unique. I think it's pretty interesting. And just for our newer listeners too, MakerDAO. DAO stands for DAO, Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And DeFi, you're going to hear us say that a lot. DeFi means decentralized finance. So it's decentralized and kind of autonomous, like Victor said. And DAI is the name of their stable coin that's backed by Ether as collateral. And you have to over-collateralize it because the asset, of course, is volatile. So I think that's a really good primer into doing what you're doing right now, which honestly I don't know a lot about, so I'm kind of excited to hear about it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with our DAI?
Sure. Yeah, let's maybe take it like a step lower first. Let's just talk about this concept that we talk about inside decentralized finance or DeFi. We call it money Legos. The fancier word is composability, but what it really is just you build a smart contract that does something useful, especially if it is has like a primitive, utility, something like a stable coin, right? All of a sudden you have stable money now, and you can do a lot more with stable money. People are more willing to use it than they are a volatile asset. And so that DAI becomes one of the key money Legos inside of the DeFi system, the stable coin DAI. And so the concept of money Legos has been exploding over the last, 15, 18 months or so. And one of the major sort of drivers for it is that you've seen the emergence of these liquid lending pools that have come out. So there have been a number of different lending options in cryptocurrency that have been around. But one of the prominent ones was this idea of essentially just matching, where you have Bitcoin or ETH or whatever else, and you want to lend it out and earn a return. And there's some risk involved in that. And so maybe somebody out there wants to borrow it to do something with it. And so there would be platforms to help people match up. And these were relatively slow moving. It was hard to find good matches. You would have the money locked up for the period of the loan. The rates sometimes were good, sometimes they weren't. But it was just kind of a slow, clunky thing that had a lot of transaction costs. And it was hard to find the right matches. It didn't really have that kind of fluidity. The liquid lending pools that came out, there's one in particular in Ethereum called Compound.finance. That's especially popular, essentially use a algorithm. So they look at the demand for borrowing an asset, and they set an interest rate to borrow, and then they programmatically adjust that. And then that also, let me also say that they have a spread built in, but that also sets a lending rate. So essentially, if something becomes more in demand, if more people want to borrow it than are liquidly available, the borrow rate goes up and up and up. And therefore, the lending rate goes up and up and up. So you look at this, if you have DAI, if you have ETH, whatever it is, but DAI in particular had an especially high lending rate in most of 2019. You could see it and be like, oh, I can get 12% for my DAI on an annualized basis. But it's not an annual promise. It's not a lockup. You can enter it and exit it whenever you want, for the most part. But the rate changes based on the actual demand in that block. So the compound rate would adjust every block, and it was somewhat volatile. It wasn't like a cryptocurrency volatility, but it had a lot of appeal for people because you had this sort of way of getting way of lending and getting interest immediately. You would be paid each block. You could literally go in for one block and earn.
What is the block time? Is it 10 minutes?
It's Bitcoin? 14 seconds on Ethereum.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So that's been pretty close to the number. I think it's going to go down to about 6 seconds with the transition to ETH2 in the next couple of years.
So do both the lending and the borrowing rate change?
Yes, but they basically change in sync with each other. And so there's always a spread there for Compound. That's how they make their money. But they sort of move, and it's just a simple supply and demand algorithm curve. But it's changing depending on how many people wanted to borrow it, how many people wanted to offer it to be lent during that block. And so right now, and since this has been available, you could lend and borrow ETH, but the rates have been almost nothing because it's available. There's not too many people that really want to borrow it for any particular reason. But what was actually happening with DAI was because of the MakerDAO system, as I said earlier, you actually have to pay an interest rate called the stability fee for drawing out the DAI from your collateral. And I didn't actually explain one of the major use cases here. So the thing that people are mostly using the MakerDAO system for are people that hold ETH that are bullish on ETH and don't want to sell it, but want to get some liquidity. So if you hold a bunch of ETH and you think it's going to go up, you don't want to sell it to pay your bills or to, you know, to have liquidity in your life. But the way you can use the MakerDAO system is you essentially draw out DAI, which is essentially US dollar equivalent. You can convert it to US dollars or other currencies to pay for like a new laptop or something like that. And then you would have essentially an interest rate that you're paying on that DAI that you then pay back over time. But then you don't liquidate your ETH. You still have exposure to the...
Okay, so the rationale there is if you think it's going to really skyrocket in value, the Ethereum, it's better to pay that interest rate rather than liquidate some of your Ethereum to pay your bills or go on a vacation.
I mean, that's what most people think is driving the DAI lending market, because people essentially have taken out all these loans from MakerDAO. And you can do this permissionlessly, by the way. This is also one thing that's really, 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 really cool about MakerDAO, is that all you need is collateral to get a loan. So, I mean, very common in America for people to take out things like home equity loans, but guess what? You have to go to a bank and you kind of have to say, take it or leave it from whatever they offer you.
Are you telling me I don't have to go to Wells Fargo or US Bank? I can just do this?
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, I'm not advising anybody to do this. There are lots of things to look at. There's additional risks to this than there are compared to traditional lending. And loans and this kind of thing. I mean, one thing that's very clear here is that smart contracts, as I was describing earlier, can have bugs, and they have had bugs, and they have had exploits where people can be essentially lose their funds. This is one of the major challenges of the entire Ethereum project, is to harden those contracts, to think of them almost like hardware engineering rather than software engineering. There's been this motive, there's kind of thinking about software, kind of the Mark Zuckerberg motto of, you know, move fast and break things, like ship something out there. If there's a problem, you can update it later, right? That's not the same philosophy you want to apply.
So if you're only using 2 centimeters, let's say, of your brain and the rest is on vacation, I think you're quickly going to find out that your life is going to be very difficult. You're going to be stumbling around. You're not going to be able to talk or think or really do anything. And this, I think, is a good analogy for what statism, communism, socialism, all of these authoritarian systems ultimately are about. It's about a small group of people with a lot of hubris believing that they can dictate complex financial and monetary and otherwise economic systems, by fiat. And
we're sort of kind of getting a little bit more safety as things get a little bit more developed, and you see the contracts not fail, right? It's the same thing with Bitcoin, right? When you look at the Bitcoin market cap, that's the incentive to hack it, right? There's however many, you know, couple hundred million or billion dollars of value if you could break Bitcoin. And the fact that it hasn't been broken shows that it's strong.
Yeah, that's the exciting part. But yeah, you definitely can't get your bank account hacked usually. So that's pretty exciting. Josh, what do you think about all this stuff?
Yeah, I'm quite interested to get into this a bit further. I mean, one of the things that I was reading about when I was looking into your project that actually stuck out in my mind is something that you wrote in your Medium post, and it's changing the psychology of money when you can actually spend your interest as you're accumulating it. That's quite interesting. Maybe you could expand on that. I'd like to go down that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. I think that is a good lead in to finally getting to RDAI. So I was explaining the liquid lending pools, and they are sort of another money Lego. So the first one was DAI, which is actually kind of built on top of Ethereum, but it's the first one that's the sort of bottom of the money Lego stack right now. And then you have these lending protocols like Compound, where you can permissionlessly lend your DAI and get an interest rate. And that works basically just like your bank account would, where you have dollars in it and the bank says, we will pay you X tiny percent, you know, like 0.09 APR or something like that, or maybe 2% if you're really, really lucky in America, to hold your money. And so the Compound works very similar to that. And it's paid to your account. It's paid every block as compared to every quarter, however the banks do it. But the basic flow of money is the same. And then you have on top of that, a new protocol, a new money Lego called RDAI. RDAI is essentially a wrapper on top of DAI that separates the interest from the principal and allows you to program the interest. And so you could take 100 DAI and say, I have the opportunity to earn interest on this, or I could do nothing with it, which is probably the worst thing you could do with it, because you probably should do something active with it, because there's a lot of really cool things you can do with DAI. But if you're going to do something with it, you could say, I can keep all this interest for myself, or I can redirect it. I can program it. I could say, I'm going to keep this 100 DAI and then send all the interest that I would otherwise be entitled to a charity. And it never comes to your wallet. It literally is redirected from Compound to the designee. And you could program this with up to, in the current version of RDAI, up to 50 addresses. So you could send it to 50 different things, and you would set different proportions depending on how much you wanted to go to each. And so it's a pretty neat way of thinking about new ways to do digital commerce. If you think about what it would be like to, you know, be able to pay like a Netflix bill out of interest on a savings account where your balance never goes down, you don't feel the sting of loss. There are a number of different cognitive biases that we, go through life with, and a number of them affect money and the way that we think about money. And it's one of the well-accepted cognitive biases that we feel the sting of financial loss greater than the gain of an equivalent amount, like a dollar.
Oh yeah, loss definitely. Feels, I mean, that's evolutionary necessary, right? If right. As we evolved, we grew up in in harsh environments, so we evolved in really harsh times. A toothache could kill us, get an infection and see you later. So our ancestors are basically programmed, hardwired to be risk averse. So the pain of loss is so much harder than the thrill of win or the thrill of gain. So you're right, and especially that is hardwired into all humans. So that's part of the pain process when it comes to interacting with money. And actually, that's part of the pain of poverty that a lot of people experience. And if this RDAI can help to alleviate some of that poverty, I think that that's a very noble vision that you have. So the R in the RDAI is just standing for redirected. Is that right?
It actually stands for redeemable. It's not especially descriptive. I think redirectable is probably a better acronym. I didn't write the original smart contracts. I got involved a couple months after that. It was it's an open source project, by the way. It's not a company. It's not something that any one person controls. And it's a project to sort of create new tools for folks. And we've been really excited about building on top of it. I got involved just from a volunteer perspective. I'm still a volunteer, but we are building projects and dApps. DApps are decentralized apps. On top of this protocol that we're pretty excited about, because they're showing people a new way of doing things. And I guess one way to kind of really make this concrete is that the reason that I'm on your podcast today is because I helped build an app called R Trees. That's the letter R, trees.dappy.dev. And the idea, and that's Dappy with a Y, .dev, D-E-V. And the idea there is you would take DAI and you would use the RDAI protocol to plant trees. And the way this works is we partnered with a nonprofit called Trees for the Future. They've been around for about 40 years, and they have a track record of being able to plant about 10 trees for every dollar donated. And what we're doing is saying, let's just use RDAI interest. It has three different buttons that you can land on when you see the front page. You can either agree to plant 10 trees a year, 30 trees a year, or 100 trees a year. And you're doing this without spending money. You're essentially foregoing interest in the future to do this. So it doesn't feel the same way. You're not actually seeing the balance of your account go down. You're simply saying, I want future interest to not come back to me, but to be redirected this way. So we're using the term spendless giving to describe this. And so it's a very different way of thinking about it. And what we actually have on the site is the button that you actually click doesn't say, buy this many trees or invest or lock up. It says activate DAI. And activate there is the idea that you hold it. You've got 100 DAI in your wallet. It's not going anywhere. It's just simply you're not going to take the potential benefits you can get from the DeFi money, like as I described, into your wallet, but you're sending them somewhere else. And at the end of it, you can stop at any point. You don't have to wait for a year or anything like that. You could stop one block later or any moment and essentially get your DAI back. and or decide to keep the interest for yourself. So you actually just click one of these three buttons, and what it's actually doing is calculating based on the current rate that you can get for DAI on Compound, which is about 7.58%, I think, right now. And it's a relatively, you know, good interest rate on essentially US dollar-backed crypto. And what it's doing is figuring out at that rate, how many DAI would you need to use rounded to plant 10 trees a year. So does that, did I explain that well? I want to make sure that
On the website, I didn't see it listed. I see a bunch of other ones like for Venezuela and a few others, but it definitely makes sense. And also too, you know, you said you could send it to 50 addresses. So you could do some for the trees and some for another charity. You could also do some for yourself too. If it's like 7.6, you could say, okay, I want 4% to go to the trees and 3% I want to accumulate or something. So there's a lot of options too, as far as how charitable you want to be from zero to whatever the interest rate is, really.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and there's not a built-in fee to any of this stuff. You could program it yourself. Now, you do have to pay gas costs on Ethereum. They're kind of similar to transaction costs on Bitcoin, because essentially what you're doing whenever you do anything on Ethereum is you are actually running some code and making sure that other people that have Ethereum nodes are running that code to make sure that it's processing the right way. So code could be as simple as, I am sending this one ERC-20 token to a different address, and that actually follows along a certain series of code instructions. And it's very common, but they all have to process. And so you need to actually pay gas depending on how complex the code you want executed is. And so,
right. And yeah, when Ethereum 2.0 comes out and proof of stake is going to be available, do you think that this will then therefore make it completely free? It'll be free, no, feeless.
I don't think so. No, I think that the idea of paying gas for essentially machine operations to go through, and that the people that are validating the transactions still need to sort of be compensated to run that and confirm that. I think that the idea of gas will continue in ETH2. It'll likely drop. And there's also a number of different ideas for layer two solutions, where you sort of have side chains and things, and those are much cheaper from a gas point of view, or free. And then there's also a number of different patterns that are emerging where the dApps that users are actually going to use are fronting those costs, the gas costs for the users, using something called meta transactions and relayers. So essentially the user might not even realize that gas is being used to sort of do the crypto transactions that they want to do, but there's some sort of revenue model that the dApp is using to get more revenue than the gas that they're paying out for their users. So it may appear to be free, but I don't think there's plans on a technical level to remove the concept of gas from the Ethereum system.
Okay, good. Thanks for clarifying that. I wasn't too sure. All right, that's pretty cool. I mean, honestly, that's really interesting, the way that this works. So you can find it at rdai.dappy.dev, right?
So that's actually, that's not exactly right. So I should maybe clarify. There's the RDAI project, and then there's rTrees. And rTrees is kind of a side project that just a few of us have come up with. And so the site to check out is rTrees.dappy with a y.dev. And that's okay, the one that you cool. can use your DAI to activate. Now, one of the things we should also point out is that if your users aren't familiar with DeFi and this kind of thing, this might not be the best thing. You might want to take a look at it. It's a really beautiful website, I think, and it does some really cool stuff. Like, you can actually see the trees growing once, or like a representation of the trees once you've done it. But you need a MetaMask wallet, which is one of the ways that a lot of people in the Ethereum and DeFi space use to interact with dApps. And you need to sort of be comfortable with self-custody of your own crypto, and you need to DAI. So we're right now, we kind of have divided the world up in our minds into three zones. There's essentially the DeFi zone, and there's about 40,000 people in the world in that. There's a report that came out at the beginning of this year that kind of did a good job estimating how many people are using DeFi on a monthly basis. And then there's the Coinbase / larger crypto space, or anybody that's ever invested in crypto and maybe held it on an exchange somewhere. That's hundreds of millions of people. And then you have the remaining billions in the sort of normal people category. And so, we're trying to build something for DeFi first.
That's important to mention, is like the crypto space is still pretty small, and the DeFi space is a small chunk of that larger crypto space. But yeah, I'm looking at the website. It's really well done. And yeah, it doesn't take a lot of DAI to plant 100 trees a year. And it looks like it's a new project, but we've already planted over 500 trees. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of location, or are you going to a certain geographic area, or is it kind of spread out? Or
yeah, so we're just partnering with Trees for the Future. They're at trees.org is their website, and they have installations all over the world. They plant in you know different climates and different areas, and their site is probably the place I would refer folks to where those trees are actually going. And what we're actually doing with our trees is we're just essentially collecting a donation that is going to our trees. Sorry, going to Trees for the Future. So it's really much more about, like, you can imagine the metaphor of like at church, somebody passing the collection plate around, but you're doing it and you're passing the collection plate and asking people to just sort of drop in some potential interest that they might earn on their money instead of, you know, out of pocket spending and then collecting that and sending it to the charity.
You're just saying, please forgo like 1 or 2% of your potential future gains and your interest that you won't realize personally, but this interest will go into a good cause or something that you believe in. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And also I think it's really going to work on the psychological side, which is really important. Now, you mentioned that only 40,000 people are in the DeFi space. And earlier on, we were talking, I don't know if it was off air or not, but I think you alluded to the fact that there is a really good amount of use case in developing world countries and economies that are not quite as developed as they are in the United States, the UK, the fintech hubs of Hong Kong and Singapore. Where do you think that this could go in the future, and which marketplaces do you think that DeFi is actually the most suited for?
So I think it's going to be useful for everyone, I think, because I think the fact that we're designing stuff that people essentially in the first world find compelling, because the interest rates are much, much higher than you can get from the traditional banking infrastructure. That's already a huge sort of selling point for it, even in the world that has access to financial services. But the big thing I think that you alluded to, and that I think folks in this space are aware, is that the vast majority of the world does not have access to good quality financial services. They're not able to have a place where they can store their money safely, to transact safely, to be able to earn interest safely, to invest safely. And so, you know, DeFi, I haven't even touched on all these things that are around it. I don't want to give your listeners any kind of suggestion that what I was describing is the sort of extent of what DeFi is doing. There are dozens of really, really, really cool projects, and people that are making synthetic assets is one of them. And that's, so you could imagine somebody that is in a developing country using a synthetic asset in DeFi could actually get exposure to Tesla. And these are really neat. All they do is they work almost like the MakerDAO system, where you would need to collateralize the price of Tesla. Let's say you wanted to issue one share of synthetic Tesla. You would need to essentially back that and then have it be have a price feed that was fed into it that showed you what the market price of Tesla was, and that your synthetic Tesla would appreciate or depreciate depending on what was happening in the real world. Now, you wouldn't, of course, get voting rights as a Tesla shareholder would, but if the vast majority of people that invest in stocks are doing it for speculative gain purposes and to have an investment as opposed to control over the company. And so the idea of synthetic assets and access to those being permissionless and global is a really, really powerful use case. And you could imagine how to combine that with something like a DAI savings rate or a DAI lending pool rate, where people are, you know, making this whole basket of financial products for themselves, and nobody can tell them not to. All they need is connection to the internet. That's it.
Yeah. Well, there's one person that can tell them not to, and that's the government. So I was kind of curious, how does these wrapped assets, like a wrapped Tesla asset and all this DeFi, what are the regulations like in the US? Because I kind of feel like, you know, if I bought a bunch of wrapped Tesla assets or other assets, it would kind of be hard to be compliant, at least in the US. Maybe in other countries where there's not those rules, it wouldn't be an issue. But maybe with your legal background, I don't know if that's your expertise, how would that work? Do you think I could just buy like 100,000 worth of wrapped Tesla assets and just go YOLO, or what would I have to do to be compliant doing something like that?
I would advise you to seek out legal advice on your own in particular there. But I think, no, I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole as far as advising on the legal status of that. But I'll say this, that, you know, it's there's a lot of things that are involved in that. There are a lot of different points at which you could sort of analyze that. And I think one interesting thing is another Andreas Antonopoulos quote is that, you know, whenever somebody says something could be illegal, you have to always ask, illegal where? You know, like if you live in a developing world, they don't really care about U.S. security regulator, interest in protecting American citizens from particular types of financial products. And so the fact that this stuff is permissionless, you can create it and people can use it and people have different risk appetites, is really kind of the bigger, I think, factor here than whether or not things have been blessed by regulators in the US. That obviously plays a big role. There's a lot of movement in that space, a lot of interesting things emerging. And of course, you know, I don't know what those companies that are creating these kind of derivative and synthetic markets are thinking about as far as their connection to regulators in the US and other places. But it's certainly something that is, there's a lot of energy developing. And I think these tools really at the end, I mean, you said there's one person that could tell you to stop, and that's the government. And I guess the question would be like, you know, why would they do it and how would they know? And if people in, you know, certain parts of the world are using this to essentially get access to financial services, it's unclear to me exactly like how their government could even be aware that they're doing that. You know, there are certainly things you want to protect people. There could be new regimes that spring up to help kind of regulate the permissionless DeFi space. And I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. We do want people to be safe. We don't want, you know, we want to protect people from scams. We want to protect people from a number of different things. But I guess sort of a philosophical point here is that a lot of the regulatory regime in the United States has grown up because of the fact that there wasn't a different way to protect people from things that they knew were going to happen. You know, like the con artist that scams people with something promising future returns, that's the reason that the SEC exists. There's a long history of that in every country on earth. And the SEC essentially said, if you want to make those kinds of claims about future returns and gains, you need to essentially disclose how you think you're going to do that. And you need to keep telling people what your revenues are and what your risks are. And that's this whole SEC disclosure program. And that's a good thing for protecting people for sure. And I guess some people find it, you know, onerous, but at the same time, it's for a good cause. And one of the really exciting, yeah, you know, possibilities of DeFi and the blockchain project writ large is this idea that we can potentially use code to reduce the vulnerabilities that the regulators were actually protecting people from. Right.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are millions and millions of paragraphs of code that are out there, like literally, yeah, millions, which is trying to protect people in different ways, shapes and forms. And maybe some people argue that, you know, it's preventing innovation in some respects. But then again, the argument is that you need to protect some people against themselves in some cases. So yeah, I think the stuff that you're talking about is really interesting. Years ahead of time, though.
Josh, yeah, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you know where there are no DeFi regulations?
Go on. Is there a joke here? What's the punchline?
There are no DeFi regulations on the dark side of the HODL moon.
Okay. All right. <cool. laughs> All right. Nice. So actually, there's one thing we wanted to get into, which is we touched on for a second, but we didn't go into the details, and that's the high priests. What are the high priests?
Sure. So that's the newest addition to the RDAI family. That was a hackathon project that we made at ETH Denver. So ETH Denver is essentially the homecoming of the Ethereum community. We have DevCon in the fall, which is the prom, which is the big showcase, and everybody shows up and there are big speeches and this kind of thing. And then there's a number of different hackathons that the Ethereum community goes to, but ETH Denver is kind of considered the bell of the ball in that space. And they have this cool space in Denver that's like an old car dealership, and it's like five levels high, and they have all kinds of weird sort of exhibits and art and DJs and nap rooms, and food is free and drinks are free, and people are working all night and building all kinds of weird stuff. And so we built something there this year, just about a few days ago, which got back yesterday, called High Priests. And it uses RDAI. It's essentially influencer-directed social giving, spendlessly. So it's kind of our trees, but what if you could say, I mean, the sort of metaphor that might be a cool one for the sort of normal version of this down the road would be Elon Musk could designate like three charities that he really likes, and people could use RDAI interest to direct the interest to those charities, and they get to follow, you know, Elon, become a member of his flock. That's the term that we're using in High Priests. So what we did is we chose nine Ethereum High Priests, like nine people that have sort of high status and high visibility in the Ethereum community, and asked them each to designate three different open source projects that they believe needed more funding. And so that this is one of the big things. It's like, how do we keep the open source rails going and maintained within Ethereum so that everybody can build on top of it. All these people depend on these things being able to be open and used by other developers, and they need to be maintained. And so that needs funding. And right now, the sort of model is typically like big grants from big grant, you know, giving agencies. And that's not the best and certainly not the most decentralized way to go about sustaining, you know, this Web3 project. And so High Priest is kind of a proof of concept showcase of a way to use social influencers to essentially get more money into, you know, charitable causes, in this case, sustaining Web3. But then also to have a little gamification thing where like potentially the High Priests are starting to compete with each other, because even though they're not getting any money, they're not getting paid, they're not putting their own money up, there's some sort of pride thing that they're doing where they, you know, there's a leaderboard and whoever's on top, you know, gets to sort of brag to the other influencers like, oh yeah, you see people wanted to vote to resources to the causes I support, meaning they think I'm cooler than you kind of thing. So we're trying to essentially turn, you know, potential passive aggression and competition for reputation, basically like Twitter, we're trying to turn that into social good.
I like it. Yeah. Twitter for social good. I mean, if you can pull that one off, you've really pulled off the miracle of the 21st century.
right, exactly. Right. Yeah. I'll accept the Nobel Peace Prize now, please. But no,
you deserve one if you can do that. I mean, I've got one of my favorite comedians is called Dominic Frisby. He's just recently put out a track called Passive Aggression. So it's quite amusing. If you're interested in that, check it out. All right. So that was a really interesting series of things that we went through there, especially like this money Legos that you've introduced us to. I think it really makes sense. So starting with the foundation of DAI, and then you brought in the compound.finance, and then how our DAI is basically a wrapper on top of DAI, and then how you can have this redirected or what was the term you actually, the official use, not redirected?
It's redeemable, but I think RDAI redeemable. Is probably better.
Okay, RDAI is, yeah, let's keep it RDAI, keep it simple. And then finally, ending on the High Priest, these influencers that can basically help this RDAI be spent in a good way. I think it's really interesting and fascinating. I honestly think it's years ahead of its time, though. It is for the 40,000 people that are the hardcore DeFi people. And if this technology keeps evolving and the UI, the UX, the experience for the mainstream person gets good enough that it can just be deployed without them really realizing what it is and it's just useful, that's when you can cross the precipice and go into the mainstream and hit those billions of people, especially when it comes to the emerging economies. Like I can see it being massive in Africa, huge in Latin America, huge in Southeast Asia, which ironically is where it's needed. Vitalik has said, how many unbanked people have we managed to bank? And so far, the answer is not many. So if we can have these DeFi solutions, then I'm all for it. I'm a big fan of it. I'm really glad that you came on and shared this with us. So thanks very much indeed. It was a pleasure talking to you and listening to what you had to say. Clearly very lucid and intelligent. So that's always a pleasure. I normally have to listen to Cade every week, so it's quite a change.
No,
I'm only joking, Cade.
I know. I want to add too that I kind of think it's ahead of its time too. I think what talking about High Priest, or I noticed there's other ones you can give for the Dev Fund, or you can give to charity for Venezuela, which I think is good. I think when I think of our trees, I think of it like a Venn diagram. You know, a lot of people are charitable. A lot of people, you know, like the environment or like planting trees. And then the third circle is like the DeFi, which is like really small. So like, but once the DeFi space increases, the other parts of the Venn diagram are already there. I think it just, we need more people in the DeFi space. But obviously, you always got to start somewhere, you know. 10,000 Bitcoins for a pizza, and now look at where we are. We're talking about DeFi Lego blocks on top of things that, you know, gets complicated even for people that have been in the space for a while to understand. Mm-hmm. But I think you made it really easy to understand today. I don't really have any other questions. I don't think Josh does. So I kind of leave you with the final thoughts.
Yeah, sure. No, I think I agree with you both that it's at least at the cutting edge. I don't know if ahead of its time is right. I mean, there's a great, I think, William Gibson quote about how the future's already here. It's just not well distributed. You know, like there are people that are like cyborgs, right, that are always online in a virtual world and have these crazy interfaces, but there's like 10 of them, right? And so I think that, you know, this feels like the world to me, but every time I go talk to human beings out in the world, especially people in my actual physical space and life, you know, I'm reminded that this just feels like a tiny, tiny, tiny corner of the world that nobody has anything like the base understandings to be able to appreciate or get excited about. And so one of the things that's, I think, exciting is an opportunity to talk to you guys and your listeners about sort of why we think it's exciting, why we think it's something that's a little bit more sustainable. I mean, I think in some ways, this kind of thing, RDAI in particular and DAI, are almost the exact opposite of the narrative of 2017. It's not, and it's, apologies to the name of your podcast, it's not about the moon, right? It's about like almost boring grandpa level good financial advice, like earn compound interest on your savings and you know, do charitable things with it and make good financial decisions and grow your wealth at a reasonable pace rather than make one bet that pays off.
I mean, we did have a couple of different ideas for the name of the show. One of them is the dark side of the negative interest rate, but it didn't really have the same ring to it. So yeah, we decided to go with the dark side of the hot moon in homage to you know, Pink Floyd, and has a nice ring to it. And the dark side is for us is to go behind the scenes and start talking to people like you that are really on the cutting edge. So we've really appreciated it. And I think that we'd love to have you on in the future, especially as you've planted, let's go for a milestone. Have you got any particular milestones in the amount of trees that you want to plant in the next year or 5 years or even your lifetime? Have you thought about that?
Yeah. Well, so there's a worldwide initiative called the Trillion Trees Project. And I think we were thinking about ways to sort of start to leverage that. But what we really are planning for is like the phase two, because we can put like on ramps on this right now. We could put it so that you could use your Apple Pay or Google Pay or a credit card to start doing this. You know, that you would, you know, come from the world of regular money, you would get DAI, it would get turned into RDAI, you'd be planting trees from interest, and you would be able to pull back your principal whenever you wanted. But it's very cutting edge, and we kind of aren't really sure that the sort of infrastructure is in place, the risk disclosures, being able to like explain to users really what this is. Because like, you know, the whole crypto space, right, had a lot of issues explaining what keys are to people and self-custody and this kind of thing, and they still do. And so DeFi has even more that needs to kind of be disclosed and to build a framework to make sure that it's a safe place for the next wave. But I think within a year, we are going to be talking about like going for that Coinbase set. So I think, I don't know if I want to put myself on the record here, but why not? Let's make a stretch goal. Let's say 100,000 trees in a year.
Wow, that's awesome. So I think you can hit that target for sure.
Hey, that's a huge goal. And Josh, let's end it here. And we're going to end it with a huge goal of our own. So Victor, we really want to thank you for coming on the show today. And Josh and Cade, we have a big goal ourselves. We're going to use our trees to create a domed lunar forest on the dark side
of the Huddle Moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehuddlemoon.com. Oh.